This is The Record on KUOW. I'm Ross Reynolds. The 2011 magnitude 9 earthquake and tsunami off the coast of Japan killed over 15,000 people. It caused level 7 meltdowns at 3 nuclear reactors. This spring marks 50 years since the Good Friday magnitude 9.2 earthquake and tsunami that devastated Alaska and killed 139 people, including 5 in Oregon and 13 in California. What will the next earthquake and tsunami bring? The next tsunami is the title of Bonnie Henderson's new book, subtitled Living on a Restless Coast. It's about advances in our knowledge about tsunamis with a focus on the Northwest Coast. Bonnie Henderson is a journalist and author of 3 books. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
So you're kind of looking at this growing knowledge we have about earthquake and tsunami potential through the story of this one guy, Tom Horning, and he runs a one-man operation called Horning Geosciences in Seaside, Oregon. How does his life kind of track our growing knowledge about this?
Well, when I first met him, and he loves to chat, and he told me about an experience he had as a 10-year-old when the 1964 tsunami from Alaska came and surrounded the house he was living in and could easily have washed him to sea but didn't. And it was a pivotal moment for him. And then I found out his history, which fascinated me, that he became a geologist, moved away, worked around the world, came back and is now living in that same house at the mouth of the river in Seaside, the most vulnerable place in town, and yet is more aware of the risk than anybody else. And that, to me, was the germ of the story.
He lives in the most vulnerable place in the most vulnerable city on the Northwest Coast.
Yeah.
Why is Seaside so much more vulnerable to tsunami than any other place in Oregon or Washington?
You know, it's just as vulnerable as Ocean Shores, Grayland, Westport. What makes Seaside a little more vulnerable is because it has more people. But like those places, it's not easy to get to high ground. And almost all of Seaside, including 3 schools, are at about 10 feet elevation. They're very low. And in Seaside, you have to cross 2 rivers to get to high ground. So if the bridges hold, you're good. But the bridges are all but 4 of them are very old and are likely to collapse. So it makes it a very vulnerable place.
And there is a fault line off the coast of Oregon and Washington. It's got the potential to create a larger earthquake than that one in 2011 in Japan. What have we learned about that fault over the last 20 years?
I mean, literally everything we know about it is pretty much in the last 20, 25 years, which is why a lot of people don't know about it. We've learned that there has been this series. Actually, we have a 10,000-year history now of 40 different ruptures of that fault line. We know about how far apart they are. We know about how big those earthquakes are and subsequent tsunamis. So we have a pretty good sense of how often they occur and how big they are. And they range from, sort of the high 8.5, maybe up into beyond magnitude 9. What a lot of people don't realize is that a fault line like the San Andreas Fault, which has much more frequent earthquakes, can't make an earthquake that big. And it can't make a tsunami because it's not primarily underwater. So although we're much less likely to have an earthquake on any given day, the one that we have here, those in the past and the next one we have, will be far bigger than anything that you've heard about in California.
You know, when it comes to a volcano, oftentimes you can tell the ground is shaking, something is about to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And they say sometimes with something like the Cascadia subduction zone, this fault, that we're due. In
mm-hmm.
some general way,
mm-hmm.
we're due.
Mm-hmm.
What's the word on this huge fault off the coast of Oregon and Washington?
You know, for one thing, there is literally no way to know when an earthquake is about to happen. All the research in Japan and other earthquake-prone places, there is no way to predict it. All we can do is look at the intervals of past earthquakes. And one of the interesting things is they tend to come in clusters, not in every few weeks or months, but a few clustered just a few hundred years apart, and then there'll be a big gap. Those clusters tend to be 3 to 5 earthquakes, and then there'll be a big gap. So the last one here, which was in 1700, was the 4th of a cluster. So we don't know if the next one is about to happen, it'll be the 5th of a cluster, or if we're done with that cluster and we won't have another one for 600 or 700 years. There's no way of knowing.
And yet it's there, and it would be so devastating.
Yeah.
Awareness of it has risen over the years with the geological knowledge that's come forth, but it's not as though public policy change in exact lockstep with our increased knowledge, is it? There's been reluctance and slow starts and stop and start.
A lot of people really don't understand the situation, probably because we have these tsunami warning sirens on the coast, and we think, great, so we're okay. Well, those warning sirens are really only useful and intended for a distant tsunami. An earthquake far across the ocean causes a tsunami. We have hours of warning. And people get those mixed up and think that they understand what a tsunami is. They get a warning, they have a few hours to get off the beach, and it's all good. They don't realize that the big one, which has not occurred in anybody's lifetime here, or even familial memory, hardly, except Native Americans, that one we'll only have 15 or 20 minutes of warning on the outer coast. And in the Strait of Juan de Fuca and further in, you'll have more time, but very little warning.
What could you do in 15 minutes?
Run to high ground.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, that's what everybody needs to know, is if there's an earthquake that shakes for 46 minutes, you need to get as fast as you can on foot to the highest ground you can get to.
Now, you recount a scene where they're talking about funding for these tsunami warning systems, and one of the people in charge of paying for it asks the person testifying, well, when's it going to happen? And they can't really answer that question, as we cannot answer. And there's a fair amount of skepticism about spending money on these early warning systems.
Yeah. Well, actually, that scene in the book was before that occurred in the early 80s, before this research began, which it was in about 1986, that before scientists found actual evidence in marshes of prior earthquakes. So there was a sense that something might have happened. We have this fault line off the coast that's been known for quite a while. The mystery was, why were there never any earthquakes? Well, never is a relative term. There haven't been any since 1700, but no one was living here at the time keeping records. Other than oral records.
There's kind of a funny story. One of these first tsunami alarms was actually the recording of a cow.
Yeah, that's funny. In Cannon Beach, they called their tsunami warning system the Community Warning Sirens or something like that, and the acronym was COWS. And the fellow who was testing the system thought, what am I going to do? I got to drive around town and see how it sounds and where we should place these sirens, and I don't want to alarm people. And his friend jokingly suggested, well, why don't you, it's called COWS, why don't you get a recording of cows mooing? To this day, I think they may have switched it recently, but if you go to Cannon Beach on Wednesdays, you hear the alarm being tested, and it is mooing bovines. It's hilarious.
We're talking with Bonnie Henderson about a new book, The Next Tsunami, Living on a Restless Coast. And she's writing primarily about our coast, the Northwest Coast. What other precautions have been taken, given that we know that this earthquake and tsunami could be so devastating? Is there any other way to prepare?
You know, there communities are slowly coming around and taking steps. I will say, in Seaside, they have 12 bridges, and four of those bridges were rebuilt to contemporary seismic standards and are very likely to hold. That happened shortly after 2000, though, and nothing has been done since then. There's one of the school districts on the Southwest Washington coast is in the process of building a tsunami evacuation shelter, because in that community you could not run to high ground and fast enough. So the school district has taken it upon themselves to build an upward vertical evacuation building, and it's my understanding that is actually underway. In Seaside, the school superintendent is doing his best to try to move that entire school campus onto high ground, but it's a very hard sell because it's extremely expensive. And what frustrates me is, when that tsunami happens, billions of dollars of federal aid will flood into the Northwest. I just can't understand, except that I do understand politics are not easy, why some of that money can't be spent ahead of time to move those schools, not rely on local taxpayers to have to spend $123 million to move four schools.
Well, you know, this is a present discussion here in Puget Sound with the Oso landslide, where there was ample information about the weakness of that hillside and the dangers it might pose to what's going on below. But it's human nature not necessarily to worry about something as might seem as abstract as that until it happens, and it's anything but abstract. And when it comes to a fault line and a tsunami, it even becomes more abstract in the mind, doesn't it?
Yeah,
totally. With the pressing issues.
Yeah, also, we know that landslides happen now and then. I mean, you can probably think of one that's happened, even small or large, somewhere in the Northwest. Well, never in anyone's memory here has there been a tsunami here. It's just very hard to wrap your mind around it. And one I one of the things that helped me kind of understand this, a guy was who's done research on similar kind of thing, dealing with massive wildfires in the Intermountain West. How do you get people to think about that, to prepare for that? It's like he said, we need to create memories of future disasters. And I think that's sort of what I'm trying to do with this book, is help people create memories of this future disaster so that you can take it seriously. And without that, why would you spend a dime moving a school when you can't even afford PE uniforms or a French class or art class?
What would the size of a tsunami be if we get hit with a 9-plus magnitude earthquake on this fault right off the coast of Washington and Oregon?
Size is kind of relative, because there's size on the beach, and then in harbors and bays it can get magnified. But it could be 30 or 40 feet high. It could be 100 feet high. It just depends on the size of the earthquake and the landform.
You mentioned Seaside, the most vulnerable city on the coast. How does Washington's coast compare to Oregon when it comes to vulnerability?
Well, it's about the same. The only difference really is the size of the population. And there happen to be more people living on the Oregon coast. Washington's coast is much more remote. That's really the only difference. A couple of communities there, Ocean Shores is extremely vulnerable. All of the towns on either side of Willapa Bay and Grays Harbor are very vulnerable. Places like Aberdeen and that have high ground to run to, the lower areas will get inundated, but people will have time and space to get to high ground.
How about those areas just inland that are connected to the ocean but perhaps protected a little bit? And I'm thinking of Astoria at the mouth of the mm-hmm. Columbia, and then the Strait of Juan de Fuca, which connects directly to the ocean. What would happen in those places in the event of the big one?
I'm not as familiar as the dynamics into Puget Sound. I do know that, for example, the state parks on the Strait of Juan de Fuca, you'll have about an hour. You'll feel the earthquake, so there'll be no doubt what's happening. But you'll have about an hour to get to high ground. So those places, for that reason, are really not nearly as vulnerable. Also, the tsunami diminishes, as we know, over time, so it won't have anywhere near the impact inland as it will on the outer coast.
What are still the remaining great unknowns about the next tsunami, Bonnie? What have geologists not figured out yet? What are the big questions that they still are working on?
That's a really interesting question. I wish I could answer it. I think people are, I know that there are people who are trying to get a better sense of how to warn people inland that an earthquake is coming. I'm not sure of the great value of that. I'm not sure what the next steps are for scientists. Everybody would like to be able to predict an earthquake, and people would like to be able to give an accurate warning of how big a tsunami is. But a lot of that stuff, it's the most important thing is education. Improving infrastructure and then educating people about what to do when it happens. And that's kind of tough to do, because that may go on for hundreds of years.
How about early warning? I've heard in the recent Chilean earthquake, some people got a phone call, like a minute it warning them, like very shortly after it happened. There's an early warning system set up in Chile.
Yeah.
Is there anything on the early warning side of this that we might be able to have progress on?
My own sense of that is it's sort of a false promise and not particularly useful. Even in Japan, one of the things that happened was that tsunami in 2011, that earthquake was so big it actually overwhelmed the instrumentation that the scientists in Japan had. So the first warning that went out to people on their phones, on radio and television, was that it was a 7.9 earthquake and the tsunami would be about yay high. So people evacuated to what they thought was a safe level. Well, the technology was wrong, and what people should have done is sort of follow their instincts and just keep walking uphill. So I think it can be dangerous to depend on technology. The smartest thing is to know what to do and do it. And people have said, well, how high should I go? You should keep walking until you just should not stop walking, and then you need to stay there, because a tsunami is not a single wave. It's a series of waves. So there'll be a huge wave. The second wave may be bigger than the first wave, and it could go on for 24 hours of surges. A few hours may pass, another one will come in. So the best thing to do is to educate people what to do and to just do it.
Bonnie Henderson writes about the new knowledge we have about our restless coast and what might happen in the next tsunami. The book is called The Next Tsunami. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Thanks very much for having me.